There are two Senate races left unresolved. There's the race that goes to a runoff in Mississippi and, of course, Florida. And that is being recounted. Ian Mailheiser, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund, editor of Think Progress Justice. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Dina Gesder, Nermin Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Massoud, Trina Nadura, Tay Murray, Astudio, and Libby Rainey. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Go to our website, democracynow.org, for all video and audio podcasts and transcripts.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 8 o'clock, and coming up next, the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show looks at how big oil helped to defeat a number of pro-environmental issues in last week's election, and they take your calls.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a developer. This 32-hour-a-week position develops and implements the yearly fundraising plan, develops promotional and press materials, and supports the anti-oppression work of KBOO. Send a cover letter and resume to Delphine Crescenzo at del@kboo.org or send to KBOO Development Tire, 20 Southeast 8th, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Please answer in the cover letter the question, why is KBOO important? Deadline to apply is Sunday, November 25th at midnight. More information on the development director position is available at kboo.fm/development-hire. 2018.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Rally to Protect Our Coast on Saturday, November 17th at 11 a.m. at Esther Short Park in Vancouver. Protect Our Coast rallies against new offshore drilling and exploration that is proposed off the West Coast. Offshore drilling and exploration threatens the ocean beaches and will impact the coastal economy reliant on fishing, recreation, and tourism. Again, that's Rally to Protect Our Coast on Saturday, November 17th at 11 a.m. at Esther Short Park, 605 Esther Street in Vancouver. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Levin and Levine, LLP, attorneys specializing in personal injury law. Levin and Levine offices are located in Southeast Portland and Old Town Sherwood. More information is available by phone at 503-946-8708 and online at levinandlevine.com.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey.
Well, I don't know.
Well, you don't know what?
Well, my pen leaked all over my jacket and all over my shirt and all over my pants.
That's good radio.
Yeah, it's really important. People care a lot about that. And it's bad. I'm sad. This is KBOO 90.7 your FM dial.
Yep.
And this is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. That's Abe Proctor, and he's the rational one. And I'm Joe Uris, and I have ink all over. 231-8187. We can talk about ink or...
Do you correlate spilled ink with irrationality?
Well, no. I correlate...
Had you been more reasonable this morning, your pen would have remained intact.
Well, no. I want to just say that it was an on-point pen.
It was.
I just want to make that clear.
Oh, thank goodness.
I work hard to steal those pens, and I expect that they work.
All right, so we want to talk recap the results of last week's election. That's worth noting, I think.
Well,
in the context of our show.
Yeah, except it was all fraud.
It was?
Oh, yeah. Trump said.
Oh, he did he?
Yeah, he... Yeah, he did say that.
Yeah, he did. It went, I think now the dust is pretty much settled. It went more or less as expected, I would say. The Democrats retook the House by a wider margin than was originally thought at the close of Election Day, because here in the most advanced country in the world, we haven't figured out how to count votes in a reasonable period of time.
Well, I just want to say about that I don't understand why you can't have paper ballots. People mark them, and that's it.
Yeah, I don't understand that either. That's what they do in Canada. Every time Canada has an election, they count all the votes in one night.
Yeah.
Everybody fills out an optical scan ballot, much like we use here in Oregon, and they fed it in the machine, and they count it up, and there you have it. Now, you might be tempted to say Canada has a lot fewer people in it than the United States. You'd be correct. But it seems to me it's simply a question of scale, right?
Well, and many other countries don't have this problem either.
Right. But moreover, it seems to me to be a paltry investment to make sure that we have the type of voting infrastructure necessary to conduct a quick and easily verifiable election.
Yeah, but then you couldn't manipulate it the way we do.
Well, no, you couldn't, see, Joe, but I'm arguing that would be a good thing.
You mean not manipulating it would be a good thing?
Right. You wouldn't have a situation like you have in Florida where there's a gubernatorial election that's now going to a possible runoff because of a bunch more votes that kept trickling in, votes from soldiers stationed overseas and so on and so forth.
Soldiers shouldn't vote.
Yeah. You also have a Senate race in Florida that's being recounted. One of the candidates, I'm going to guess which one.
Democrat.
No.
The Republican, yes.
Yeah, the Republican has sued to bring the counting of the votes to a halt because apparently in the land of conservatives, voter fraud has now become equated with actually counting the votes.
Yeah, well, I remember in 2000 they cheated Gore out of the presidency.
Well, they did. And
by the way, the recently appointed member of the Supreme Court was part of a crowd of shouters that forced the issue.
Oh, yeah, Mr. Kavanaugh. He just keeps popping up, doesn't he, at these little key points
in history. I wouldn't
say
he's a bad man, just a sleazy man.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Is that a fine line? Rational world, a fine line between sleazy and bad. We have all these problems with our electoral system. It would seem to me to be a paramount importance to invest a relatively small amount of money to make sure this doesn't happen. It could easily be done.
But it wouldn't allow for the sleaze that makes it possible for Gore to lose when he was winning and so on.
Yes, there is that sleaze. I'm glad you mentioned that. But I remember, and I saw echoes of it this time. You remember back in 2000? Let's cast our brains back in
back.
Yeah, they were the Gore campaign was out making all kinds of high-minded statements about the integrity of democracy and that we must count every vote. And so you remember all that?
I do.
Meanwhile, the Republicans were sending in armies of lawyers, and they were waging a bare-knuckles brawl for what turned out to be an election of world historical consequences.
Screaming and yelling.
Yeah. So Democrats brought high-minded statements to a knife fight. That's what they did.
Yeah, that's kind
and
of
I heard
weird.
Some echoes of that this time, but it seemed to be that they're a little bit less so. That in situations where, a very firm, even aggressive stance was required on the part of Democratic campaigns to maintain electoral integrity, they did it.
Well, hopefully they learned something, and then of course there's the factor of the fascist king.
Yeah. Okay, so what we want to talk about this time, is some of the stuff that went under the radar during this last election. Specifically, I'm talking about a large number of pro-environment ballot measures around the nation that went down to defeat thanks to spending from the oil lobby.
Well, you mean the oil lobby bought the elections?
The oil lobby bought certain parts of certain elections. For example, a measure in the state of Washington, Measure 1631, which would impose a carbon tax on Washington State, was defeated narrowly thanks to tens of millions of dollars spent by the petroleum industry in Washington.
But money is freedom.
Yeah, money is freedom, according to our Supreme Court.
Yeah.
So the oil industry must be some of the most free people walking around out there.
It's a greasy thing.
It is a Yeah, I see what you did there. So this is a problem. This is a problem, especially when we're looking at, and this is an issue that you and I, although we spent a lot of time talking about the coming environmental apocalypse on this program, we have not talked about the recent United Nations report that says we've got about a dozen years to right the ship here, to cut down on our carbon emissions before things go irreparably wrong. A dozen years.
Well, I mean, then it's over.
You think it's over already?
I think it's over.
Okay.
I'm so very depressed.
Why are you sitting in that chair?
They have children. I mean, because to turn this mighty ship around when it's being run by people who have enormous power and money, to turn it around, to tell them, gee, you know, it's going to be your kids too. I mean, that's just not enough time.
Not enough time.
I'm depressed.
Are you? So why are you sitting there?
Well, I don't know. That's a really good existential question. Why am I doing this when it's just obvious that the whole thing is, I can't use the word.
Yeah, I guess you can't.
No.
So I'd like to hear from some Washingtonians, particularly those of you who supported that carbon tax measure. Talk about what you saw and heard in the days leading up to the election.
Good idea.
We saw some of those ads, heard some of those ads here on the Portland side or the Oregon side of the Columbia River in the last days of the election. And they were, they were kind of nasty.
No, they were mean and irrelevant and illogical and untrue.
Yep. Also, there was a renewable energy mandate in Arizona, Proposition 127, which would have set a goal for all the state's utilities to get 50% of their initiative or their energy from renewable sources by 2050. Again, that's a little bit long considering the tight timeline the UN has just announced that we're on. That was pretty much crushed, 70-30. I guess that's more to be expected in a place like Arizona, but nevertheless, big dollars were spent by the oil industry to ensure that outcome there.
Yeah.
It ended up being the most expensive ballot initiative race in the history of the state.
Really?
Yeah. The state's largest utility, Arizona Public Service Company, spent itself $22 million.
Wow. In Arizona?
Yeah.
Where there's 17 people.
No, there's a lot of people in Arizona. There's more people in Arizona than Oregon.
Well, that's Arizona.
You just said it had 17 people.
I don't make much sense today.
No.
I'm too depressed.
No. So this you see this pattern repeating itself across the country. Nevada, there's ballot measure question 6 that would impose a 50% renewable energy mandate, same much like the Arizona measure, except targeting 2030 instead of 2050. But it passed.
Okay.
Interestingly enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people have credited that to the fact that Elon Musk, you know Elon Musk?
I know Elon Musk.
You know him personally?
No. I have not had that privilege.
Tesla and SpaceX.
Rocket Man.
Fame.
Yes.
He built a big, he calls it his Gigafactory in Nevada, where they're making batteries and such for the Tesla.
Right.
I don't know if this is provable in any way, but people have speculated that there's a growing green consciousness in Nevada that led to support for that measure. So we'll see. And on and on and on. So what I want to hear from our listeners today about is, first of all, given the 12-year timeline we have to save human civilization as we know it, sounds like hyperbole, but it's not.
Well,
it's really not.
If it's really true, mm-hmm. You need to be very much double-jointed so you can kiss your you-know-what goodbye, because it ain't going to happen.
Yeah, probably not.
Well, so that's very depressing, so I'll see you later.
You'll see you later, okay. So in light of this, it would seem that even the most radical-seeming propositions right now are not out of bounds, right? If we're looking at having to virtually eliminate our carbon emissions within the scope of a dozen years, you know, 50% target by 2030 or 2050 isn't going to get the job done. Yet even these relatively modest measures were opposed vociferously by the petroleum industry. It's like they just don't even give a damn, Joe.
I think they don't. This is an interesting issue because on the one hand, yeah, power and struggle over control of energy is very key. But how is it that people who have that power, who probably have children and possibly grandchildren and so on, not only do they not get it, but it's like they truly have no sense that there is such a thing as the future.
Yeah, that's really confusing to me.
It's very weird. It's very, very weird.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
Because after sea levels have risen dramatically and billions of people have been displaced and civil wars have broken out over the influx of refugees into virtually every place in the world.
But they're coming. They're coming here.
And radical and massive weather disruptions disrupt the supply chain for all sorts of industries, not to mention the supply chain for food production. And people are fighting over dwindling resources, where water suddenly becomes about as precious commodity as can be imagined on the face of the earth. What do these oil companies imagine they will be doing? Who's buying their product at this point?
Well, they're going to take Elon Musk rockets to Mars and mess up Mars.
There we have it.
I'm serious. I mean, that's the kind of thing we're getting out of the ruling, so-called ruling class.
So, like, okay, once we squeeze everything out of this planet, we're just going to evacuate to another planet?
Yeah, it's a Ray Bradbury story.
Like a contagion?
Yeah.
And give us a few thousand years to muck that one up, and then we'll find another place to go?
Well, and it's more challenging because Mars doesn't have all the wonderful things that Earth does.
Like a breathable atmosphere?
Yeah, like that.
Like
water?
Yeah, like a water cycle?
Yeah.
All right. Well, there's plenty of water up there. It's just all frozen, apparently.
Well, we actually have a caller.
Yeah, we do. Let's go to the phones. Claire.
Hey, I'm sorry that I am not from Washington. I'm actually from Beaverton.
You don't have to apologize for that.
I have an important addition to your show today, and I love you guys, and I'm so grateful for you. Today is a perfect day to call our representatives in Washington, D.C., because I think it's the climate change, I can't remember who they are, climate action. There's groups who are going to talk to them right now with human being citizen lobbyists about having a similar program but nationwide. So this is a day to say, yeah, we support that, and just to call them in and support our citizen lobbyists. I think it's a citizen.
Well, I don't remember the name. I know that this is happening. I think it's really a good idea. I want to remind people of this, to keep in touch with your members of the House of Representatives and your senators, even though ours happen to be, except for one, really quite good on these issues.
Right. And then the second tiny point is,
yeah.
Joe, unfortunately, you're right.
Oh, dear.
The ship is absolutely going to sink. But here's why: you got to stay where you are and keep doing what you're doing. Because after you get all the way through your grieving process about, but I wanted to live longer and I wanted to, you know, have the arc of justice actually get to the end of the rainbow and the pot of gold and all that good stuff, that's not going to happen. But we still can live lives of love and excellence. And that is what this time is calling us to do. And there are support groups. You can check them out on the web, or I know I hate Facebook, but it is a way you can connect with people who are aware of near-term human extinction due to abrupt climate change.
I love
and
that.
We get together and make each other feel better about trying to do our best against.
I am writing that down. We can live lives of love and excellence. Yes, we can.
He really did write it down. You can't see him, but he did do that.
Yeah, and that's not mine. That's from Guy McPherson. But I agree with him, and it took me this much catastrophe to get the spiritual teachings of every spiritual sage in history, but now I get it.
Well, you know, here's my personal dilemma, and I maybe it's really boring, but I will share it anyway. This has been an ongoing crisis for a long, long time. I mean, I happened to have been one of those young guys a while back who could see it coming. And
right.
There was then literature about it and
right.
Bright, really bright scientists saying it. Now it's so common, so obvious, so clear, so undeniable. And yet the moneyed class, people who you would think would be interested in the long-term view, have become short-term viewers, absolutely. And that may be inherent, and I'm not sure this is true, but I think it is inherent in the nature of capitalism. That is that they cannot look further than the edge of the room.
The next profit. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, beyond profit. But I want to thank you, and I think your suggestion is really good. By the way, even though I get depressed and threaten to quit, etc., I am still enough of an existentialist to say you must continue the struggle no matter how it goes.
Right on, Joe. I'm right there with you.
So do reach out to the House and Senate members and to the local government and to make yourself heard. And when necessary and when logical, go into the streets.
Yes. Yes, and do it today. Make those calls today because our lobbyists are there today, the citizen lobbyists.
Great. Thank you very much
for
the
call.
All right, thanks, guys. Bye.
Bye.
I love that. Live lives of love and excellence.
Well, why not? Why not? Let's go out. Might as well. Let's go out to Anita in Vancouver.
Good morning.
Good morning, Anita.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
I can.
Indeed we can.
Loud and clear, as they used to say in the radio world.
Oh, fine. Okay. I went door to door for 1631, and even though the people we spoke to, for the most part, were supportive, I was not surprised. I just had a feeling that all those misleading oil company ads, and they were buttes, would derail it. And one of the reasons was that even when the Columbian, which is generally a decent newspaper here, came out against it, it was only half-heartedly against it, but it was saying, but, you know, this could cost us, this is flawed, we need to try again. The problem was nobody was considering how flawed business as usual is. Nobody was counting the cost of keeping on the same trajectory we're on. And somehow we've got to get these assumptions that people are making that because we here in the Pacific Northwest, wildfires notwithstanding, are more shielded from climate change than other areas
You're
of
right,
the country.
For now.
That does not mean that we're not affected and that we can just assume that business as usual will be fine and the climate will be as reasonable now as in 5 years as it is now. I don't believe anything like that. I moved up here 6 years ago from Texas. After a summer in which my hometown, I wasn't there, it was just 71 days of 100 or more in Dallas, with new overnight low highs of 86 four times and 85 four times, when previously the new overnight low had once been 85.
Well, if it weren't for the fundamentalist Christians, it would be logical to be a nudist colony, all of Texas. Sorry, just, I digress.
My hometown of Wichita Falls, Texas, I do not mean Kansas, Falls, friends, had 100 or more days of 100 or more degrees and a new overnight low high of 88. And it was the summer of, 2011 that persuaded me that I would not stay there. And I had family up here, finally was in a position that I could escape.
Well, I think you're wise to escape, and I think, though, that since it's a global situation and since we're the leading cause of the problem, I think it's probably almost pointless to run away.
Oh, well, but you can at least, that was an idea I got from a major climate scientist on a talk show on the NPR station in Dallas. And the climate expert, and this was maybe 2005, I don't remember, it could have been Michael Mann, it could have been someone else, but he basically said, okay, at that time, he said, we've got about 10 years to turn things around, and if we don't, we really are fried. And people aren't going to do it. People aren't going to do it, so go ahead, do what you can to protect yourself, and for me, it's not just enough to look out for number one. The only way I can stand any of the politics or anything else is by doing my part locally with going door to door for 1631, fighting for 4.5 years to keep the oil terminal out of here, because you can't fight every single battle. The Quakers have some wisdom in that they say you should find your concern, and mine is saving the earth.
No, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's quite all right. I was just going to say that's the thing I can say, and until people get it in the visceral way that I got it with the summer of 2011, although I had started really getting it beforehand when it stopped cooling off at night in Dallas. You can't do what has to be done to turn this disastrous set of policies around unless you get it absolutely at the gut level. And I think people are beginning to, because a lot of people know people in California with the wildfires. I mean, this isn't something that you can say, oh, yeah, I understand climate change. You don't understand it until you really get that it is going to wreck your life and, above all, the lives of people of younger generations that you may love.
Yeah.
And I've taken plenty of your time. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for
the call. Thank you very much for the call.
I just wanted to comment on the California situation because it is another example of insane Trumpism. Trump, who absolutely must have grown up in a airless cage, was criticizing the Forest Service, of all things, for the fires that are taking place in California. But they didn't happen in the forests. They happened in the suburbs, where people live.
Yeah, this was after an entire town had been destroyed and multiple people had lost their lives.
A town ironically called Paradise?
Yes.
I think that what we all need to understand is that our government is steered by a madman. I'm serious. It's steered by an absolute madman who has a distinction of being probably the most ignorant person ever to hold high office in our country. And this is we've never had anything quite as weird as this, nor have we had the kind of crisis, the onrushing crisis, that makes all the other kind of politics small, even though it's large, if you follow me.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe... I often cite Dorothy Day because, though I'm not Catholic, she is one of my heroes. And she often cites the notion within Catholicism of the sin of despair. Well, I fight that a lot. And I think all of us need to fight despair because it immobilizes us. It makes it impossible for us to act. We cannot possibly know what, I'll say miraculous for lack of a better word, but what things may turn things around. But as time ticks on and no changes of significance happen, it gets more and more weird and more frightening. And those of us who have family, those of us who have children or relatives, we have to be filled with terror in this situation. So I'm glad we're doing this, but
yeah.
I don't know what to say beyond that.
Can I just say one thing about Trump before we go back to the business?
Sure.
Again? All right, this weekend saw the 100th anniversary of the end of the First World War.
God, he behaved so badly.
He did, and I want to get to that in a second. Now, you know, I'm usually not one on big displays of militant nationalism. I don't really go in for, big extravagant.
You don't like parades?
No, parades, are fine. But, I generally don't go for making a big deal about these sorts of things.
Right.
But 100 years after the end of the First World War, the world had never seen anything like this. This was the first fully industrialized war.
Right.
It introduced a new level of horror. To something that had been horrible since before recorded history, right? The waging of war. It was, in every respect, awful.
And it was pointless.
And it really was, you can really view the two world wars as one extended punctuated conflict, right? The end of the old colonial order, but whatever. So, it absolutely an occasion that called for a reverent recollection and a somber examination of what happened and why this came to pass and why we need to do everything we can to avoid it in the future, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
It absolutely required the presence of the American president. But he didn't go because it was raining.
Yeah, well, it was raining.
It was raining.
I mean, he has to waddle in the rain. Waddling in the rain,
it's terrible.
Not a good thing.
But it was, and again, I usually don't go in for these sort of things, but incredibly disrespectful.
Yes.
To the military and to the soldiers who fell and to their descendants.
Let's call it what it is, unpatriotic.
Yes, thank you very much. And it brought to mind all those times, remember all those times when Obama dishonored the military because it was raining? So many
no,
times.
No, I can't. There was never a time that Obama didn't show up.
But, that's just, all he had to do was show up. All he had to do was show up.
Well, but the helicopter wasn't working, maybe.
Yeah, I know. I digress. And I should mention before we go back to the phones, this is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program on KBOO 90.7. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. You can also write us at the Facebook page, facebook.com/Abe and Joe, or tweet us at HonestAbe72. So let's go back to the phones.
Michael.
Michael, good morning.
Michael got bored.
All right, Michael, you can try and reach us again if you like. Who's next? Dave, good morning, Dave.
Good morning. I'm a Vancouver voter. And all I can tell you is I think our best hopes for saving the planet at this point are for a geopolitical convulsion in the Middle East that kicks the price of oil up into the $150 to $200 a barrel range.
We've been having just that sort of convulsion for more than a decade now. Oil prices are far above what they were before the outbreak of the war in Iraq, and they have remained so.
We have not had one that multiplies the price per barrel. It's been as low as into the 40s per barrel. We need $150 to $200 a barrel oil.
So you're saying oil, you're saying fossil fuels should be you're saying fossil fuels should be so expensive that it simply puts them out of the reach of anybody, basically.
Yes, or makes people use them less thoughtlessly. Certainly.
Yeah.
And think about the traffic deaths that might not happen if the right people have to choose between a cell phone bill and filling their car up, and they pick the cell phone bill.
Who are the right people?
The people that like to drive when they're on the phone.
Oh, those people. Those people.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know those people.
If you can call them people, which I don't very often.
Oh, come on. Everybody's a person.
Just for sake of argument. Anyway, that's all.
All right, thank you for the call.
All right, I'm trying to understand. He's wishing for a huge geopolitical convulsion in the Middle East that will make oil so unaffordable that it forces our hand.
I think it's kind of a metaphor.
I think he's actually calling for a geopolitical convulsion. He's talking about the massive outbreak of war in the Middle East.
Well, we already have a horrible condition, many horrible conditions in the Middle East, many of which the United States has provoked.
Okay, well, I'm kind of glad. I don't agree with what the caller had to say, but I'm glad he called up because he's really cut to the crux of the matter here. We've known about this particular problem, incipient climate change, for a long time now.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And even before climate change became fixed in the public consciousness, we knew about things like the harmful health effects of air pollution and of water pollution and the fact that oil itself was a finite resource. We knew all of this. Then climate change came into focus and became widely accepted in the scientific community, and we knew this was coming. But nothing has been able to prod us to action. We have worked at this at the margins. We have smaller scale political actions, like many of the actions we've taken here in Portland have helped the cause, but nothing on the large enough scale to really reverse the conditions that are setting us up for catastrophic climate change. So just let me finish here. So when this guy says we need a giant geopolitical convulsion in the Middle East so that we have no other choice, I submit we've had no other choice for a long, long time now. And we have chosen the easy way. We have chosen to continue to have cars that get us wherever we want, whenever we want. We have chosen to continue to participate in a cheap and shoddy consumer economy, all of it driven by petroleum-based energy. We have known all of this, and we have done nothing. So for him to call for this now,
well,
a war of all things?
Well,
no, now's the time to make the choice.
I agree with you, first of all. But secondly, I think he's using a kind of metaphorical example of we need a crisis so great that people will wise up. I don't believe that.
He didn't make it a metaphor. He made it an actual
I know. But I really think that that's fundamentally a mistaken thought. Let me give you my simple reason. It was clear that we were running out of fossil fuel in the easy and traditional ways of getting it. And suddenly we discover fracking. And despite the fact that Oklahoma is sinking into the earth, despite the fact that all kinds of people are suffering while we frack, despite the fact that it's very dangerous to the landscape, we are now doing that to extract fossil fuels. I expect that each technology that comes along, driven by that industry, will have similar negative effects, but we'll keep doing it until such a time as there isn't any fuel really, truly left. I mean, you know, this is an example of the limits of human intellectual endeavor, and it's an example of what happens when you have absolute capitalism controlling absolutely everything. So it's without being disparage-ish, it is really, truly a very, very real crisis. And most people see it in a kind of distant fog rather than seeing it as an onrushing danger.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think that United Nations report indicates that the failure to perceive it as anything but an onrushing danger is a dereliction of duty. Now, you mentioned fracking. I want to touch on that in the context of these state ballot measures we were talking about. In Colorado, they had something called Proposition 112. And what 112 would have done, had it passed, it would have changed the minimum setback for oil and gas wells to 2,500 feet from any occupied building. Right now, those limits are much closer. So you can have an oil well, you know, across the street,
from
a school or whatever. So this would have really pushed all oil and gas operations out to the margins, because it's kind of hard to find places in populated regions. They're 2,500 feet away from any building, right? The oil industry spent $41 million in Colorado to defeat this measure. They outspent their opposition almost 40-1.
Well, and you're right. And, of course, I grew up much of my life in Southern California, and I remember oil wells in people's backyards. I remember oil wells. There were oil wells. There was one of those children's fun center places, you know, with rides and so on. There was an oil well right in the middle of it.
Oh, yeah. You can still see a lot of that in Southern California.
Yeah, I mean, it's creepy, and at first when I was a little kid, it was kind of exciting, but then I began to realize what I was looking at, and by the time I was 12 or so, I understood what was happening, but it was...
Yep.
Now it was done.
You mentioned earlier the limitations of capitalism and sort of this self-defeating feedback loop it finds itself in. Now, the opposition to Proposition 112 in Colorado was saying essentially this is going to kill the oil and gas industry. If we have to do this, it'll be the end.
Yay!
Yeah, probably not. But let's for the sake of argument, pretend that that's true, right? Say the passage of that ballot measure would have killed the oil and gas industry. So essentially what the petroleum industry is arguing there is that our right to continue to exist as a market within the larger system of capitalism is absolute and essential and worth all the money that we can spend on it. That we have the right to continue to exist as an industry. I submit to you, gentle listeners, that there is no industry on the planet that has an essential and intrinsic right to exist. They do not. They are products of a consumer economy. They exist because people choose to consume that good or service. If people decide to consume something else, then those industries fade away. It's happened time and time again. They do not have a right to exist. We can choose to do things differently, and they will just have to cope with the outcome.
Well, I agree with you. Let's go to the phone.
Let's do that.
We got Michael.
Michael, good morning.
Good morning, guys. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so the problem, if you want to look at it that way, is that the carbon dioxide cycle is out of balance. More is being emitted than is being absorbed, so it builds up in the atmosphere.
Yes.
You guys are talking about slowing down the emission half of it.
Mm-hmm.
There's another way to do it, which is to speed up the uptake half.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
If you get it into balance, then mm-hmm. it won't increase.
Yeah, reforestation, planting of hemp crops, all kinds of things can do that.
And there's this thing that's been known about since at least the 90s, which is that if you put like iron
shavings in the bottom ocean, of the ocean, yeah. You've called us up about...
as much carbon dioxide as you want to biologically onto the bottom of the ocean. So I talked to my environmentalist friends about this and go, okay, look, we got a problem. Mm-hmm. Here's a possible solution. And all of a sudden, they're going, well, what about unintended effects? And to me, that's like you've been screaming about how your house is on fire. The fire truck pulls up, and all of a sudden you're worried that the water from the hoses is going to ruin your couch. Is the house on fire?
Now, I don't think that's an accurate metaphor.
Maybe we should do something. What?
I don't think that's an accurate metaphor. I mean, environmental consciousness, Michael, requires one to think systemically and to think about the ecosystem in its totality. We don't know the consequences of dumping millions of tons of iron filings on the ocean floor. We don't. And to do so would be irresponsible.
Well, this is something that has happened. See, the thing is, this is something that has happened naturally. The reason they even knew about this was that looking from satellites, they would see that sometimes parts of the ocean would turn green.
Michael,
it turns out... Wait, let me just finish this.
Okay.
And it turns out that it happens because there are sandstorms, dust storms in the Sahara that pick up a lot of dust from there, and then the prevailing winds come from the west to the east. It blows over the ocean and then falls out in rain and stuff. And that dust has iron in it, and so temporarily there's this green patch in the ocean, and then it goes away. So this is something that you could stop doing it instantly, and everything you were doing would stop. And it just seems crazy to me that we're not at least pursuing this the way you would pursue the Manhattan Project, because the UN just said the house is burning down. Here's something that could really work, and everybody's talking about other things.
So I'm going to just parse this because I get a little confused. You're saying a number of different things. You're saying it was really great that we developed the nuclear weapons. A dubious question, a dubious solution.
When did I say that?
You just said it. Manhattan Project.
No, I didn't. No, I said we should have a Manhattan Project to develop iron ore thing.
Yeah, a concerted effort that spares no expense. That's what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you think that's going to happen?
I think if the impression that the house is burning down keeps growing, eventually I hope it will, and I'm trying to help make it happen by talking about it.
Okay. All right, I'll stipulate to that, Michael. I'll say that I think it's legit to consider this tactic amongst a slate of other actions to both limit CO2 emissions and increase CO2 uptake from the atmosphere.
See, Michael, part of the problem I have with your discourse is that you're unwilling to acknowledge the actual and radical problem. And I believe that the actual and radical problem is an economic system that is out of phase with the ecology and with the actual world. And that is not solvable by any remedy that we have, even technological remedies. We're not, I want to be clear about this, we're not able to use the technology that you even suggest because there isn't even the will to do that.
There would be the will to do that. That's cheap. It's really cheap. Iron is incredibly cheap.
You misunderstand me. I'm not even arguing about whether or not it would work. I'm saying there is no will to do that. If you said, okay, let's have a political solution, let's dump iron in the ocean, let's say it's a good idea, and then you have to have the Congress that would vote for it or a UN that would support it and so on. And in fact, vast sums of money from people who I can't understand why they're so short-sighted would be pouring in to make sure that didn't happen. So what I'm saying, given the condition of humans, given the wisdom or lack of wisdom of humankind, the crisis is virtually inevitable at this point. And what you want to suggest is a technological solution that is very profound in its impacts and its possibilities, and yet extremely unlikely. That's all.
You say extremely unlikely. Yeah. I say China's building a new coal plant every week, I've heard.
What's that got to do with it?
Cars. But I'm saying that getting this iron thing going is going to be a lot easier than convincing China to stop building coal plants or to get people to say, I'm not going to have a car anymore. I mean, it's going to be much easier than either of those two things.
I'm a little confused here. I just want to say one thing. To say that there are easier or harder solutions to a problem of enormous magnitude and to argue them in a hypothetical or abstract way doesn't do it. The fact of the matter is, China's doing a lot of bad stuff. It's also feeding its people, which is unique to China's recent past. So what? The fact of the matter is that the powers that be, are not going to turn their attention to this. Our concern here at this point is that even though it is not in the long-term interest, it is not in the long-term interest of the people of the world, this is not something that's going to happen. It's just not going to happen. Michael, I'm going to have to let you go. But I appreciate your perspective. Thank you.
Okay, I will. I think we should take something important away from that conversation, though, and that is that we need to be willing to consider solutions that may seem counterintuitive or unorthodox or really far outside the box.
Or very difficult to do.
You're right. At this point in the ballgame, everything needs to be on the table.
Okay.
Absolutely everything needs to be on the table. All right, 503-231-8187 is the number to call. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program on KBOO. Let's go to Joe. Good morning.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Good. Two things. First of all, Michael is somebody who wants to continue playing with matches inside a house full of gasoline that burns down. He wants to keep playing with the matches, so he uses the fire truck thing. You know what I'm saying, right?
Oh, well, yeah, we understand what you're saying.
He wants
bad metaphor, though, it is. Yeah.
Right. Okay, so I wanted to talk about 1631.
Yeah.
1631, I read the whole thing. The exports of fossil fuels were exempt from the tax.
Oh, really?
Yes. Now, why would they be exempt and the oil companies protesting the tax? Unless they were the ones that wrote the thing.
Well, that's almost almost a conspiracy theory, man. I don't know.
Well, now here's my point. Their only argument against 1631 was that it would impose thousands of dollars of extra costs on every consumer in the state of Washington. But what is the single greatest driver of price of anything?
Demand.
Supply and demand. In the United States, we consume approximately 15.5 million barrels of oil per day, regardless of source. And yet, in the United States, we're exporting 2.25 million barrels of oil every day, and a large part of it is going to go out of the state of Washington, plus the coal, plus the liquefied natural gas. I mean, it was only 10 years ago they were trying to get liquefied natural gas import facilities in Washington and Oregon. And now they're talking about exporting it. They do this Gordon Cove thing down on the Oregon coast, and you're going to see the price of natural gas in the state of Oregon go through the roof.
Well, you're probably right. I think, the
conservatives and the financial industry, they have one overriding driver of pricing of everything, and that is supply-demand ratio. It is the only thing that they ever care about, and it's how they manage to manipulate through speculation and false flag issues. Okay? We haven't had a true pricing of oil since the October of 73 Egypt-Israeli war, where we had the first oil embargo, and that was the cause of all the inflation that's happened since then. In spite of what all the deniers say, that was the driver of inflation. And look who got blamed for it: unions and anybody who had cost of living increases. Okay, cost of living increases were 6 to 9 months behind the curve. They didn't cause it, they were a reaction to it. Energy, the price of energy, we had a rebound in the same scenario in 78-79, and then we had another one here at the beginning of the Bush administration with Enron. Okay, those prices haven't gone down. And well, yet, look at what we're doing. We're exporting all this energy to the same companies in foreign countries that used to have living wage jobs here in the United States.
No, I think you're right. I think a lot of your points are really good. But I want to make another and very important point, which is my fundamental point. As long as we depend on a system that is built around the profit of a few at the cost of the many, we will not be able to solve even the most basic of problems. And that's why I am very challenged. And I think, I see you do agree. So it's really obvious. You're giving specific examples of the reality which most Americans are unaware of. So I appreciate that. I'm going to let you go because I've got a lot of people in line. I think it's a good conversation. Thank you.
Agreed. Jeremy, good morning.
Speak for yourself.
What?
I don't have that many good mornings, and I haven't had any since.
Oh, okay.
All right, how about morning?
The Nazis started killing,
Okay, Jeremy, why don't you just say morning?
3 million of us.
All right.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess I wanted to complain about the tone of the two of you ranting for the first 15 minutes.
Okay.
There's something about, as a vegetarian, when I walk into McDonald's...
Why would you walk into McDonald's?
Let me finish. Should I be surprised if they don't offer me a veggie burger? Of course not. Should you be surprised or shrill or strident about anything that's happening? This is exactly what you should expect.
So you don't think outrage or anger or an expression of dismay are appropriate?
Well, it's just the surprise. It's like, I'm outraged and I'm dismayed, as are you. But there's something about it. It's like, well, I'm outraged and dismayed that you can't get a veggie burger at McDonald's, but I'm not surprised. I'm not going to complain about it because I don't expect them to do it. I don't want to complain about Trump. I want to stop Trump.
Wait a minute, Jeremy. I understand your point, but here's the deal. Without arousing discontent, without serving up the awareness of what's going on, there is no resistance. This show, though it has a probably little audience compared to the great media world, is attempting to create that disturbance. And that's why we make the points we make. It's not because we don't know what's going on. It's not because we are trying to be original or new. It's to, as the Wobblies used to say, create the necessary discontent for people to really see what the hell's going on. That's what we're doing. Okay?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, even though theoretically they're my comrades because we both use the big A word.
Anarchist, okay.
Yeah, anarchists like Wobblies, i.e. sort of, you know, they're functionally syndicalists, have plans for other people. They want them, you know, syndicalists want people to join their big union and have a big strike and everything will be fine. I want people to think for themselves and create our futures together. I'm not prescriptive for other people.
Oh, okay.
Nor do I think that I can hector them into doing something.
Well, I don't know what else one can do, and if you have a suggestion.
Well, again, yeah, I'm a hectoring sort. So in some ways, I suppose I'm suppressing myself. I think we share that. Anyway, I thought it was particularly funny and a little sad that you. I love Michael. I would like to meet Michael, but I. No, you wouldn't.
Difficult. Anyway, go ahead.
No, you're. Have you met him?
No.
You listen to his tone. He's not strident. He's just, you know, he's wrong about so many important things, but he's real bright.
Yeah,
and you were just somehow presuming that he was, you know, thrilled about, you know, American nuclear supremacy. He was, you know, he's just making an analogy about the Manhattan Project, and you immediately wanted to jump on him, and so you did, and you know you were totally off base. It was just really funny.
Okay.
And a little sad.
Sorry, did you call just
anyway,
to?
Anyway, thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks. I'm wondering, did he call just to police our tone, or did he call to make a point? Sounded like just to police our tone.
Well, I'm not going to apologize for my tone.
So you mentioned being
you don't like my tone. The hell with you.
He mentioned being a vegetarian, and I thought he would follow up a little bit more on that. But while we're talking about reversing the climate change, probably the biggest single lifestyle decision that Westerners can make to have a positive impact on that process is giving up the eating of meat.
That might be true. That might be true. But what it's going to mean is that all the soybeans that we need to trade to China will have to be eaten by us.
Well, that's good. We have plenty of them now because soybean exports to China are down 90-something percent.
Yay,
because
Trump.
Of Trump's tariffs.
Yay, Trump.
Yeah. All right, let's go back to the phones.
Be here.
Harvey, is that you?
Yeah.
All right, what's on your mind?
Well, the American Automotive Association says the average price of a gallon of gasoline is $2.73, but I think I peg it more at $10 to $12, and according to the energy group called Securing America's Future Energy, that's made up of retired military and business leaders, the cost to the military to defending oil supplies, including everything from guarding shipping lanes to maintaining troop commitments to in key oil-producing nations, turns out to be $81 billion in 2017. And number two, the taxpayers' cost for climate catastrophes due to our excessive burning of fossil fuels in 2017, the third warmest year on record, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration said that the weather climate catastrophes cost $306 billion. I peg it at about $500 billion. So when we buy a gallon of gasoline, I think that what comes out of our pocket is $2.73. But the rest of it comes out of our taxpayers and insurance payoffs and losses to everyone. But the good news is that solar panels, once installed, they cost about $8 to $10. They take about 8 to 10 years for the payback. But if we buy an electric car and plug it into our solar electric rooftop, and we don't buy gasoline, the payback is about 4 to 5 years. And then we, because they're warranted for about 20-year lifetime, you have 15 years of free electricity for your house and your car. And so I think that that's the way to go now.
Well, I would agree. And thank you very much for the call. And I'm glad you gave us that analysis, because the true cost of a consumer good is usually a lot larger than the price you pay, you know, at the pump or on the shelf or what have you. And what that caller just laid out, that the expenditures that we undertake to have a military presence in the areas where this oil is extracted, to get it here, to refine it, and so on and so forth. All of this carries an enormous cost to taxpayers and a cost, a human cost, in terms of the people who live in these areas who have to live under the thumb of a U.S. military presence.
Well, and the cost, since
right.
we're a day after Armistice Day, or what we're now calling it Veterans Day, the cost in lives in among Americans was horrific.
Right, indeed.
And that was a war that was about imperialist power, a struggle really over Africa.
Right.
And it it did not solve anything. It set up the situation where inequities were so great that we ended up in European fascism.
Indeed. And let's look at Saudi Arabia as just one example of this. That's a corrupt, theocratic, dictatorial regime that's been propped up for decades by American wealth because we want to keep their oil flowing into our cars and everything else. Saudi Arabia's been involved in a war in Yemen now for several years.
Horrible war.
That is an absolute catastrophe in human terms. Famine, disease, massive displacement, human suffering on an incredible scale. But have we cut back an iota of that aid? No. In fact, Saudi Arabia is one of the largest recipients of American military aid in the world. So the human cost, the environmental cost, the economic cost of petroleum-based goods far exceed what actually comes out of your pocket when you go to purchase them.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah. So we need to start thinking in those terms.
I think that the paradigms under which we grew up, in fact, the way in which we teach, for example, American history, are fundamentally full of lies. And the result of that is we don't have an intellectual base for logical thinking for many of us. I mean, when I was going to school, and I had American history in the eighth grade and then again in my junior year of high school, in both cases, I was told that this is a democracy. Well, it isn't. It's a republic.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference is very important. There was no attempt to make everybody able to vote, except for many, many struggles over the rights of persons of color, over the rights of women, and over the rights of people who didn't own property. It was always an elitist endeavor, which was, for its time, progressive. But very shortly thereafter, it was not so much so. Once the French Revolution took place, it really wasn't the case. So what we're really talking about is a mythological nation which sits side by side with the real nation, and in which our educational system is engaging in the myths rather than engaging in the reality.
I would agree with that in large part. I think maybe that I got a more open-eyed
you might have had a better
education
than me.
Maybe. But, we learned about some of this stuff, that it wasn't all the way the myth portrayed it to be. But I want to say again something that I've said many times on this show, that while that myth, may not be grounded in reality, it has still been the driver of an ongoing struggle for real and lasting equality in this country. We have struggled since the very beginning to live up to the words that the United States put down on paper. And we have made inexorable progress in that regard.
I agree with that.
So there's some value to the myth, even though it's easy to shoot it down. It has still animated our social development to a huge extent.
I agree with that, and I don't agree with that.
Okay.
Okay. But I also think that it's really important to understand that the possibility is always there. I still believe, even though the onrush of the climate reality is very fast and very powerful, that it's possible, not probable, but possible that we may, not just with technology, but with democracy, work our way out of the situation.
I hope so. I think we can.
Well, only if...
But if big oil is able to buy elections the way it just did,
yeah,
then that day is farther and farther out of reach.
I think we've run out of time.
Yeah, I think we're pretty much
end. I hope we haven't over-depressed you. You all got to get out there. You all got to make noise. You got to scream and yell and beg and whine and plead. And for goodness sake, keep on keeping on.
We'll be back at you next week.
Square. feel that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
KBOO is excited to be part of the 2018 Willamette Week Give Guide. This year, Willamette Week and KBOO are challenging our community to give with their dollars and take action by showing up in real life. KBOO has been showing up for over 50 years. Give to KBOO today and you get full access to the Chinook Book app, plus freebies from Laughing Planet, Gluten Free Gem, We Press, and Nosa Familia Coffee. You can contribute right now at kboo.fm/give or call 503-231-8032. Support KBOO, where music makes the movement.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 9 o'clock. Coming up next on Alternative Radio, Benjamin Hett discusses how Hitler happened. At 10, you'll hear Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, Humankind discusses ways to build a healthy diet. At 11:30, Art Focus features interviews, artists, curators, and critics. All of these KBOO programmings are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
There were refugee and migrant flows, particularly across Germany's eastern border. So this is really where Hitler comes in, because the message that Hitler and the Nazis started to develop with great political success in the late 20s is basically, we're the party that will stop this. We're the party of, if I might put it this way, putting Germany first or making Germany great again. There are historians who tell us Hitler's what happens when you have too much democracy. And there are historians who tell us Hitler's what happens when you don't have enough democracy.
That's Benjamin Hett, and this is Alternative.